We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the America Centrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Happiness is mentioned twice in the opening sentences of the Declaration. First, we hear the claim that one of our three inalienable rights is the pursuit of happiness. And then later we hear that it is the right of the people to abolish a bad government and then create a good government in order to secure our safety and happiness. The Declaration also suggests that bad governments are bad because they make us suffer. In other words, they prevent us from experiencing happiness. Indeed, suffering is mentioned three times in the opening of the Declaration, so one more time than happiness. Jefferson writes that we are more inclined to suffer, while evils are sufferable, than to become happy by overthrowing our government and creating a good government that frees us in our pursuit of happiness. So bad governments are bad because they make us suffer, and good governments are good because they make it easier for us to be happy. Okay, great. But after revolting against the bad government and creating a good one, then what are we supposed to do? How exactly are we supposed to pursue happiness? Is there a right way to do it and a wrong way? And what does happiness mean anyway? Is happiness the same as pleasure, the opposite of suffering? Or is it something else? And are we really responsible for our own happiness through our own efforts, our own agency, and our own free will? Or is true happiness really out of our hands, something that just happens to us due to sheer chance, luck, or divine providence? What did Thomas Jefferson even mean by this? And what did other colonials mean by this? Did they have a religious concept of happiness, a philosophical concept, a political concept, a psychological concept, a scientific concept? And did all these concepts of happiness conflict, or did they overlap and support each other? Lastly, of course, what did happiness mean for women, for enslaved Africans, and for Native peoples? Was the pursuit of happiness an inalienable right reserved exclusively for white men with property? Or did it apply to others as well? As you might have guessed, our theme today is happiness, and I'm delighted to have with me a fantastic scholar who literally wrote the book on happiness, Professor Darren McMahon. Welcome, Darren.
Thanks, Andy. Great to be here.
Are you feeling happy to be here?
I am indeed.
Darren McMahon is the David W. Little Class of 1944 Professor of History at Dartmouth. He is the author of numerous books, including Divine Fury, A History of Genius, and Equality, The History of an Elusive Idea. Most importantly for our theme today, Professor McMahon is the author of Happiness, A History, which has been translated into 12 languages and was awarded Best Books of the Year honors by the New York Times, The Washington Post, The Library Journal, and Slate Magazine. Links are in the show notes. So Darren, happy Darren, how do we start unpacking that rich and mysterious word happiness in the Declaration of Independence?
Well, all kinds of things to say, but let me start by just talking about the word happiness, and you alluded to this in your intro. I love to make the point that in every Indo-European language, without exception, the word for happiness is cognate with luck. So in English, the root is the Old Norse and Old English term hap. You find it in Shakespeare. Shakespeare says, you know, hap what hap may. It's the root of the word happens. But it essentially means luck or fortune. And, you know, right across, as I say, the Indo-European languages, this holds. So in German, as you know, Glückseligkeit, Glück too means fortune or luck. And going all the way back to Greek and Latin, this connection holds. And that seems to point out a view of happiness that you find in almost all traditional societies. And that is that happiness is not in our hands. Happiness is what happens to you, and individuals don't control that, right? The gods do, fate does, fortune does. We're the victims of circumstance and what happens to us. And in most traditional societies, what happens to us in the end is often kind of unpleasant, right? Famine and plague and war and disease and suffering. I always point to the first work of history in the Western tradition, Herodotus, who uses this line from Greek tragedy, call no man happy until he is dead. And then in the mouth of a Persian sage, Artabanus, he has a riff where he says that there's no one alive who hasn't wished on many occasions to be dead rather than to be alive, because life is just so full of suffering and whatnot. So that's a kind of ancient and received idea that is very much contested in the 18th century. But there are a couple of other things that we could say about happiness, because in really every major religious or wisdom tradition, this is true of Greek and Roman philosophy, especially in the Western tradition, but really of all the religious traditions, suffering is problematized. In other words, people begin to ask, why is it that human beings suffer, and is there anything that we can do about this? So Plato is a great example. Plato specifically contests that older view of happiness that I just referred to, that, you know, happiness is what happens to us and we have no control over this. And Plato seeds the thought that actually our own actions, our own virtue in life, has a lot to do with how happy we will be in the end. And this is picked up by his student Aristotle and then becomes a kind of received point of departure in classical philosophy. But as I say, really so many religious traditions broach this subject. And, you know, a couple of things we can say. One is that they don't conceive of happiness as a kind of, you know, summation of pleasure. They think of happiness, or in the Greek term eudaimonia, as a life well lived over the whole of life. Life that will necessarily involve setbacks and sufferings, but that we can optimize. So Aristotle uses the metaphor of a plant, right? If we raise a plant with good, rich soil, and we give it water and nutrients and sunlight, it will flourish. And he posits that if we raise human beings in certain ways and we give them the right inputs and environment, and we teach them to live in a flourishing manner, they will, and that's the goal. So really, all religious traditions have this view of human flourishing. Obviously, they differ in certain ways, but that kind of point of departure is there. But the other corollary to that is that, you know, happiness is not something that just happens of its own. It takes work, it takes discipline, it takes cultivation. And there's a recognition that many people, maybe even most people, are probably not going to be up to that. So the example that I always use when I make this point is that of Buddhism. Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, teaches that all human beings have the capacity for happiness. But the first of his Four Noble Truths is that all life is suffering. All life is suffering because most people simply don't do the work necessary to achieve enlightenment. They have misplaced desires, and they are the victims of those desires. They're grasping and so forth, and this causes them unhappiness, even if they have the capacity to be happy. And so in that Buddhist view, like in a Christian view, like in almost all the religious traditions, and also in the wisdom traditions, like the Aristotelian or the Stoic, happiness is, you know, a kind of prize that's attained by the chosen few. The happy few, as Aristotle says, and it's not something that we just should necessarily expect out of life. Now, that view gets challenged directly as well in the 18th century, but we'll talk about that in due course.
Okay, so I'm really interested, Darren, in a lot of these concepts. The phrase in the declaration there at the start that I'm interested in is the pursuit of happiness. So a government cannot guarantee that we be happy, but Jefferson here makes a strong point that sort of government should get out of our way or somehow create the conditions that allow us to be freer in our pursuit of happiness. So how are we to understand this concept of the pursuit or pursuing happiness?
Right. Well, there are all kinds of things to say, but let me begin by making a point that I make in my book, that what one sees in the long 18th century is what I call a revolution in human expectations. In other words, that older religious view of happiness, and that older idea that happiness is out of our hands, something that we don't have control over, are challenged directly. They're challenged by religious forces, they're challenged by Enlightenment thinkers. And the idea is presented that human beings are supposed to be happy. that we were created in order to be happy by a benevolent creator, by nature, and that when, you know, conditions are right, we will pursue happiness and indeed find it. You know, one famous articulation of this that is important for Jefferson is that of John Locke, the English philosopher who writes about the pursuit of happiness at some length in his essay concerning human understanding. And there he likens human beings to objects in a gravitational field, and that's not coincidental. He's an admirer and friend of Newton, and he thinks of human beings as attracted by pleasure and repulsed by pain. And we are naturally led along in this way. Now, he has more to say on happiness, as does Jefferson, but that's one way of conceiving of the pursuit of happiness. It's something natural. It's something indeed good. If you start looking around for the phrase, the pursuit of happiness in the 18th century, on either side of the Atlantic, you'll find it all over the place. And you'll find it in different sources. And I think all of these are important to Jefferson. Jefferson, as I'm sure you know, famously says in a number of instances, most famously in a letter he writes in 1825 to his fellow Virginian Henry Lee, that when he was composing the Declaration of Independence, he wasn't trying to do anything new or original, but rather to kind of capture the common sense of the age, the common American mind. And I think, you know, part of that common American mind, first and foremost, are religious views. The phrase pursuit of happiness is used all over the place by preachers in the 18th century who talk about human beings' pursuit of happiness and God's desire that we are to be happy, both in this life and the next life. And there's a kind of new emphasis in religious apologetics in the 18th century that makes the point that, you know, unlike, say, a John Calvin who conceives of human beings, the vast majority, as vessels of wrath who were brought into existence to suffer eternally, that no, God is benevolent. God wants us to be happy, to flourish in this life and the next, and that religion is in fact the way to that happiness. And so that's a received idea that one would have heard often from the pulpit in the 18th century or read in religious tracts or sermons. Another major source is this kind of broader Enlightenment discussion. Locke is just the tip of the iceberg. All kinds of people talking about happiness in the 18th century and human beings indeed not only right to pursue it, but even right to obtain it. You hear talk of a right to happiness in the 18th century, which is unprecedented and novel and really quite dramatic. People wouldn't have spoken that way prior to this point. So, you know, one obvious example here is the whole current of utilitarian philosophy. We sometimes associate utilitarianism with the English legal reformer Jeremy Bentham, and Bentham does indeed talk about the greatest happiness for the greatest number and argues that the point of government is to, you know, increase happiness for as many people as possible and to decrease suffering. But that general way of conceiving of utility is a really widely received notion, and you find it in Italy, you find it in France, you find it in Germany and all over the place in the 18th century, and that too is important. There's also a whole current of Scottish Enlightenment thought, common sense philosophy, which argues that that human beings are social creatures and that they find their happiness in community, and that indeed they find their happiness in pursuing virtue. What is good for others is good for us. And so I think, you know, Jefferson is sort of drawing on all these currents, as well as the received tradition of classical thought. And we can get into this at greater length, but all the founders, and indeed anyone with an education in the 18th century, which is a relative minority, of course, but nonetheless, the founders are steeped in classical thought, Greek and Roman thought. And the connection between living virtuously and living happily is absolutely central in their minds, and they're referring to that. So classical philosophy, Enlightenment philosophy, and received Christian tradition are all really important. I'd throw one other into the mix as well. The scholar Carly Conklin has written a book about the pursuit of happiness in the founding era, and she makes the point that the legal thought of William Blackstone, the Oxford legal theorist and reformer, is central here as well. Blackstone talks about the pursuit of happiness, and he talks about the way that law should align with natural law in order to lead human beings to happiness. And Jefferson himself wasn't a great fan of Blackstone. He thought of him as a kind of Tory. But nonetheless, that general connection between law and the pursuit of happiness, natural law and the pursuit of happiness, is a widely shared and received notion. It would have resonated for 18th century folks as well.
That was such a fascinating overview of the different traditions that sort of go into this phrase, the pursuit of happiness. And I didn't quite realize how many different traditions that phrase sort of came out of. We often think of the Declaration of Independence and Jefferson's authorship as one that tried to include as many groups as possible. He needed to speak to a very diverse group of American colonists. And I'm just beginning to realize now that the pursuit of happiness, that phrase, if you are particularly religious, you get your religious hit in there. If you're more interested in political or legal theory, bang, you can read whatever you want into pursuit of happiness in that respect. And if you like your classical philosophy or whatever, you can be like, oh, that's what Jefferson means by pursuit of happiness here. So it's like a really clever rhetorical strategy to say pursuit of happiness, and then I can just now see that it's applying to lots of different demographic groups there. So really interesting. I just want to focus on sort of the key ideas in that first sentence of the Declaration of Independence, and that's this tension between what you said, the traditional view, which is that it's not really in our control to be happy or not. Divine providence or fate makes it so. But what we see sort of politically, and maybe even a little bit metaphysically, in the Declaration of Independence is this idea that human beings have agency, right? No, we are not subject to mysterious forces or whatever. We can create the conditions that help us become happy. And that, for me, when I look at sort of the awesome political relevance of the Declaration of Independence, it's in this huge change of views that no, we have agency. It's not our fate to be happy or unhappy. We can do it ourselves. And I'll just note, this is a letter that Jefferson wrote to someone. He notes, "Our greatest happiness does not depend on the condition of life in which chance has placed us, but is always the result of a good conscience, good health, occupation, and freedom in all just pursuits." So again, our greatest happiness is not based on the circumstances of our birth, but we have this agency over our happiness. So what do you make of that in the Declaration?
It's absolutely central, and it's absolutely central to this broader understanding of happiness that emerges over the course of the 18th century, that human beings, yes, have the capacity and the agency and the ability to not only pursue it, but to find it. We can understand our world, we can improve our world, we can improve our place in it. It's a broadly received notion in the Enlightenment. You know, we were talking about Locke earlier, and I mentioned Newton. Newton is the great hero of the Enlightenment on both sides of the Atlantic. Why? Because he shows that we can understand God's creation, God's world, using the power of reason. We can understand God's laws and how he orchestrated the world. God is not, in Newton's conception, a kind of whimsical being who sits up there on a cloud and casts thunderbolts down and, you know, operates in ways beyond our conception. Rather, he's predictable and knowable through reason. And what so many Enlightenment thinkers reason from that is that if we can understand God's world and God's creation, then surely we can understand the world of our own making. And so you see in the 18th century the emergence of all new fields like anthropology or political science or economics, right? All of which sort of posit that there are laws in human activities that we can understand and study in order to influence how we act in the world, in order to improve the world. And that injunction to cultivate our garden, as Voltaire famously says, and to improve it and to make life better, richer, more prosperous, more comfortable, more happy, is, again, a broadly received notion in the 18th century.
It's interesting, you mentioned there the laws of nature, and of course in the preamble to the Declaration, there's this reference to the laws of nature and nature's God. And I'll just read this for the audience again. "When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. So again, here we're having the references to the Enlightenment and thinkers like Newton and Locke. But what's funny about this also is that they're saying, like, this is not some feeling we have that we can't prove with facts. People expect us to use reason to create some sort of argument that justifies this. We're not just going to be like, oh, we're angry, so we're rebelling and becoming our own nation. They're like, you know, it's respectful to the laws of nature, to the laws of reason, that we create a case that is a logical case, that's a reasonable case about why we do this. And so there, what I'm thinking is there's also this interesting connection between reason, agency, and happiness too.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, the invocation of nature and nature's God, which would have resonated with many different kinds of audiences, and this idea that, you know, it's natural to pursue happiness. And so we're simply reverting here from a situation that's making many Americans unhappy to one in which they have the opportunity to do what comes to them naturally and should come naturally, and that is to pursue happiness.
Let's look at the sort of the opposite of happiness or pleasure, and that's suffering. Mm. So what do you make of those passages in the Declaration right after the happiness section? You know, Jefferson makes this claim about human nature. I guess we would call it a psychological claim these days, that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves. How do you read that?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And, you know, it's funny, I'll be honest and confess that I'd never sort of lingered over that passage in the way that we're doing now. A couple things come to mind. One is that, you know, effectively, Jefferson is right. My colleague, the psychologist Roy Baumeister, has done really sort of legendary work on human beings' negative bias. In other words, we're wired probably through evolution to register negative or unpleasant experiences in a more powerful and lasting way than positive ones. You know, the way that the evolutionary psychologists explain this is if, you know, you're walking in the jungle and, you know, you see a lion and you don't experience anxiety and fear, you're probably going to get eaten, right? And so that imprints on you. You know that if you're in that part of the jungle next time, to have caution and so forth, and that anxiety is protecting us. Whereas, you know, happiness, if it lasts too long, makes us soft, right? I always use the example of if happiness didn't wear off, we would, you know, just be lying on the grass eating fruit and basking in the sun and then get eaten by that lion, right? So, in other words, modern psychologists would argue that we do, in fact, suffer and register suffering more than we register the positive experience. The other thing I would say here, though, is that in this new 18th century notion, there is a further problematizing of suffering. I mentioned earlier that the religious traditions problematize suffering, and they do. They ask the question, why is it that human beings suffer? But they don't ever sort of imagine overcoming that entirely, or only imagine doing so in kind of limit cases. So In the Christian frame, why do human beings suffer? Well, because of original sin. God created us in order to be happy, to flourish in the Garden of Eden, but through our own willful disobedience, we broke the law and we passed that on to our ancestors. And so, you know, in the kind of received Christian understanding, human beings will suffer in this life. Luther says all sadness comes from Satan, right? It's a consequence of sin. In the 18th century, people begin to challenge that notion, including Christians, and argue that, you know, God didn't bring us into beings to suffer eternally. He wants us to be happy, and indeed, we should be happy. I love using this example of that kind of frame when I refer to a pamphlet that was published in the 1760s in America, and I won't get the title perfectly, but it's something like True Pleasure, Joy, and Happiness, the Immediate Consequence of Religion. And the author makes the argument that I'm making, that God intends us to be happy. And the real proof of that, the author claims, is the first miracle that Jesus performs. What's the first miracle that Jesus performs? Well, he turns water into wine at the wedding in Cana. You know, in other words, Jesus is somebody who wants us to party. He wants us to rejoice, to be happy, and here's the evidence. So you get religious voices sort of arguing that we can overcome suffering and that we should, and enlightenment voices too. Enlightenment voices arguing that human beings are brought into existence to pursue happiness and we should be happy. And if only we can remove the suffering, then we will be happy. And so the point of good government, as you alluded to earlier, and good laws, is to kind of clear the way of the obstacles that get in the path of our pursuits.
Just one point that I think is important to remember about that this religious concept of suffering and obedience to the king or the divinely ordained ruler of the place. In the colonies during the run-up to the revolution, some pastors were finding passages in the Bible that very much said, no, Jesus clearly said you need to submit to the ruler. But other pastors who, you know, were patriots or rebels were like, oh, no, don't ignore those. There are these other passages in the Bible that you should pay attention to, which say it's perfectly right. God wants you to be happy, and sometimes you might have a bad ruler, and then you can overthrow that ruler. So that religious debate is also packed into the Declaration of Independence with well, no, maybe you're not supposed to suffer, and maybe God doesn't want you to suffer. And the other point I would make, which sounds a lot like Bentham, what you were talking about, and this again is a quotation from Jefferson elsewhere in one of his letters, the care of human life and happiness, and not their destruction, is the first and only object of good government. The care of human life and happiness, and not their destruction, is the first and only object of good government. What do you make of that?
Well, again, a widely received notion. You know, when I lecture on this, I have a slide in which I show, you know, citation after citation of the founders and then European thinkers making precisely the same point. So, you know, one that I know off the top of my head is Joseph Priestley, the English philosopher and chemist and a friend of Jefferson who comes to America. He writes that happiness is in truth the only object of legislation of intrinsic value. John Adams makes this point repeatedly, that, you know, that the happiness of society is the end of government. And this is really a commonly received idea. Now, it has classical roots again. Aristotle says something similar in the Nicomachean Ethics and in the Politics. But people double down on it in the 18th century, that the very litmus test of good government is the happiness of the people. Bentham, you know, puts a kind of finer legal point to this, and people like Blackstone and others do as well. But it's just a broadly received notion, and it's very effective rhetorically in the Declaration, because effectively, you know, Jefferson is saying, are you happy? and people say, no. Well, we can do something about that. We can change it. We can address the obstacles to our proper and just pursuit of happiness. And we're going to do that now.
Good. Now, I want to sort of get another idea that we can connect to happiness. And it's the idea of prudence, the connection between prudential behavior and happiness, because, again, I'm just close reading this paragraph in the Declaration of Independence after the preamble, right after he says that we should create a government that secures our safety and happiness. The next sentence he says prudence. So like the three words we have there, safety, happiness, and then the next word he chooses is prudence, which I think is fascinating. Prudence will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. So when I see this prudence, I'm also thinking that that's a word with a very deep religious and also classical philosophical reference. The idea that extremes of behavior are wrong, that you should be careful. I'm thinking of, say, Epicurus, for example. It's more prudent in how we do things, because prudence is actually, being prudent is a key point of happiness. So you don't want to just change your government, rebel, start a revolution, without taking into account this other key feature of happiness, which is being prudent.
Indeed, and you only rebel after a long train of abuses, that famous line that you find in Locke's second discourse on government as well. Absolutely, prudence is a cardinal virtue, as you say, both in religious reflection and in classical philosophy, and it shows up time and time again. Adam Smith, when he talks about happiness, makes prudence the central virtue. He traces it to kind of Stoic thought, but it's there in Epicurean thought as well. And it's really kind of baked into a whole Aristotelian way of looking at the world. And this, you know, I think really reminds of the central point that when the founders think of happiness, they don't think first and foremost of pleasure, although that's there, and I think it creates a certain tension with this older tradition of virtue, but they think of the virtues first and foremost. So Jefferson says at one point that happiness is the aim of life, but virtue is the foundation of happiness, and that's a view that all the founders shared. And they go back to the ancients here, and they compile lists of virtues, of character virtues. There's a really fine book by Jeffrey Rosen on how the founders conceived of the pursuit of happiness, and he makes this point centrally, and indeed he organizes his whole book around lists of virtues. Jefferson made them, Franklin made them, Adams and others make them. They don't always live up to them, but they try, and you'll find prudence along with justice and even things like cleanliness and silence, as lists of virtues that we need to follow in order to live in a flourishing manner, in order to live in a happy manner. And prudence, as you say, is that ability to make the right decisions, decisions that will enhance our pursuits and that will mitigate the suffering that comes from bad choices and bad decisions.
I'm happy you started unpacking this concept of virtue, because I think we should not lose sight of the fact that the founders and Jefferson could not really separate the concept of happiness from being a virtuous person. You know, it was impossible to be happy without being virtuous. So that sort of deep connection goes back all the way again to ancient thought, as we know in Aristotle. Nicomachean Ethics, but also I often think of, in much of what the founder said, Stoicism. So Stoicism is the idea that since we can't control external things, since things happen without our control, all we can do is control our attitude about what's happening around us. It's kind of maybe fatalistic to a certain extent. But also it means what you can control is your virtue. So if you just focus every day on waking up like Marcus Aurelius saying, the world is going to be a hectic place, but every day I'm going to focus on being kind and gentle and prudent and all of these other things. If I'm taking care of my virtue, that's something I can control, and that would be good. And what strikes me as very interesting about that Stoic version of the virtues is that, again, the Declaration of Independence seems to be going against one of those central ideas of Stoicism, and the Founding Fathers really love Stoicism, really love virtue, and yet the Declaration of Independence is rejecting that key idea of Stoicism, not about the virtues, but that you don't have control over governments. You don't have control over these externalities. The Founding Fathers are like, yay, virtue, but you can control the structures that will shape your life. You can abolish your government and create a new one.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that Stoicism is very important for so many of the founders. I mean, George Washington comes to mind immediately here. He's in many ways a kind of Stoic character. But the Stoics take what is initially an Aristotelian idea that we can control our happiness, our flourishing through our own action, through our virtue, and they take it to the ultimate extreme. And they discount, as you say, circumstances, external factors or external goods. The reducto ad absurdum of this is voiced by Cicero when he's talking about Stoic claims, and he says, you know, the man of perfect virtue could be happy even on the rack, even while being tortured, right? If you everything's in place, it doesn't matter what happens to you at all. None of the founders would have shared that view. They would have been closer in this respect to Aristotle himself, who, as you know, writes the Nicomachean Ethics, named after his son, a series of lectures about character virtues. And at the very end, he segues then to what will become the Politics. In other words, He sees the character virtues as setting up life in the polis. And famously, Aristotle says that human beings are, you know, zoon politikon, we are political polis animals, we are social beings. We can only flourish in good community. And the founders share that view profoundly. They don't imagine the pursuit of happiness as a purely individual pursuit, right? We pursue happiness when we promote it for others. Happiness is interrelational. We flourish as human beings in community, and this too is a kind of widely received enlightenment view that human beings are sociable creatures and that we, you know, we are our best selves when we are in flourishing communities. And so they would reject that extreme Stoic claim, even while at the same time arguing that, yes, a lot of things are in our own control, and how we react to circumstances, how we respond to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune is to some extent in our hands. But that doesn't mean that we need to suffer just anything. And in fact, as people of agency, we can build communities, we can build governments in which we can pursue our happiness more optimally.
I'm just focusing here now on a couple of quotations about Washington's stoicism. He says in a letter here to Mary Ball Washington, "Happiness depends more upon the internal frame of a person's own mind than on the externals in the world." And again, another address to the Episcopal Church, "The consideration that human happiness and moral duty or virtuous duty are inseparably connected will always continue to prompt me to promote the progress of the former," that is to say, happiness, "by inculcating the practice of the latter," the duty.
Yeah.
So there we have our virtuous president. I'm going to bring up this point now, and maybe you can respond to it now. Maybe you want to do it later. A lot of these, and here's a passage from Jefferson that I was just looking at. "It is neither wealth nor splendor, but tranquility and occupation which gives you happiness." The one thing that strikes me about all of these virtuous founding fathers who are like, oh no, you don't need wealth or any of this to be happy. I mean, it's easy for you to say, if you are extremely wealthy, that wealth doesn't give you happiness.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, I sometimes make this point about a contemporary positive psychologist who, you know, often cite data to suggest, and I think they're right in general, that, you know, if you have nothing, then money can in fact buy you happiness. If you're sleeping under a bridge, as my friend Dan Gilbert likes to put it, money can buy you a lot of happiness. But once you reach a certain point, and it's not as high as one might think, and a couple of years ago, people were positing around $70,000 a year was the kind of optimal point. Beyond that, more money's not going to buy you a lot of happiness. So they, too, make this point. But it's funny because often the people making that point are making a lot of money. And we do know that, in fact, if you look at societies, you know, in the Gallup reporting or other data that describes the subjective well-being or happiness of societies, the happiest societies in the world tend to be well-off and prosperous. And if you look at individual countries, the happiest people in those cohorts tend to be richer, not poorer. I don't think any of the founders would have disputed the idea that having means was conducive to happiness, that having property was conducive to happiness. Now, you've probably heard this old canard that that Jefferson really wanted to say life, liberty, and property, but he cleverly crossed that out and hid it behind the pursuit of happiness. This is what Marxists used to always say when they would deconstruct the Declaration as an apology.
This is actually in my notes, so thank you.
Okay, great. So this is an apology for capitalism, right? There's no evidence whatsoever that Jefferson was thinking in those terms. You can find the phrase life, liberty, and property in the 18th century. James Otis uses it in the 1760s. Locke talks about property or estate, and this would have followed, I think, naturally from many people's, you know, kind of first principles that having property was not a bad thing, and it should be encouraged and indeed should be disseminated. And I will say that, you know, the 18th century in general is unique in making the case that material prosperity is good for us and good for our happiness. There's an old, received idea in both classical thought and Christian thought that there's something dirty about lucre, about money, right? It's the gateway to sin. It leads to greed. It leads to gluttony. It leads to excess. Luxury in classical Republican thought is always slightly suspect. It saps our virtue, our discipline, and so forth. And one can find these strains floating around in American Republican thought in the 18th century, to be sure, and Jefferson himself sometimes voices them, although he is also, of course, an Epicurean in many ways, a man who likes his wine, who doesn't frown at the pleasures of the body and so forth. And many people in the 18th century are arguing that, you know what, these things are fine. We should enjoy our body. We should enjoy good food, and we should work to materially improve our life. And they begin to make that case for economic improvement. You know, I always like to cite my colleague at Cambridge, Gareth Stedman Jones' wonderful little book on poverty, where he makes the point that until the 18th century, people thought of poverty as something that you just couldn't do anything about. There were always going to be poor people, there was always going to be poverty, and that's just the way the world was. Well, that begins to change in the 18th century, and Adam Smith and others begin to imagine that, you know, we can increase productivity, we can increase wealth, we can make the poverty disappear. That's a novel idea, and many of these Enlightenment thinkers are behind it. But at the same time, there's enough of that received wisdom from the ancients, from their religious traditions, to suggest to them that, you know, money is not going to buy happiness on its own, that without virtue, without regulation of our characters and our choices, that money will be wasted on us. So on the one hand, a kind of apology for wealth and the benefits it can bring, but at the same time, a recognition that wealth alone won't bring you happiness. And I think their founders, again, are fundamentally right about that.
Benjamin Franklin, one of his trips to Europe before the revolution started, went to Ireland, and he wrote some letters describing how appalled he was by the poverty there. And he said, even the poorest New England farmer has their own cows and sheep and their own home and all of this stuff. And he just couldn't believe that the poverty of the Irish farmer. And I think, you know, back then, certainly this idea we have, it's partly a myth, but partly real, of the New England homesteader who chops down a forest and builds his own farm. I mean, it has to do with land and also this idea of through productive work, you can be happy, have cows and sheep and whatever, and live this good life. And it, again, we also see that in Aristotle, and I can't remember where it was, but Aristotle was like, you know, in order to be virtuous, you do need certain things. You need to be healthy. You also need to have a good deal or some, at least some wealth, because wealth allows you to do those virtuous things like helping other people. You can't help other people if you're impoverished. You only can worry about yourself. So virtue is definitely part of being a good person, certainly in the ancients.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is Aristotle's point of departure, that, you know, one has to have means in order to be munificent, right? To be generous to others, to devote yourself to cultivating the good life is a privilege. The thing about Aristotle, though, is he sort of frowns on making money. It's better to have it, right? And this is a longstanding aristocratic notion, right? That aristocrats are defined, in fact, by the fact that they don't work. In French law, aristocrats are barred from working with their hands because this is somehow lowly, right? In Christian tradition, work is God's punishment for Adam's sin. He has to work the land and is kicked out of the abundant and flourishing Garden of Eden because of sin. That idea, too, is contested. Work is increasingly seen as something noble, something worthy of upright, virtuous human beings. And so that would be the slight twist here. But yes, the basic idea that one can't pursue happiness in utter poverty is a widely shared notion. You mentioned, you know, Irish farmers. I mean, my ancestors were Irish peasants, and they come to the United States in the 19th century because they were literally starving. And they saw America as a land of abundance and opportunity. And, you know, we spend a lot of time deconstructing that myth, and it's important to remind ourselves that the land of the yeoman farmers in the 18th century was, of course, taken from the indigenous, and it depended in many cases on slave labor. All of that is true, and yet there was also a certain truth to the myth of the land of opportunity. the idea that America is where you can go to make your dreams. You mentioned that I just have written this book called Equality, the History of an Elusive Idea. And I make the point there that for the transplanted European population, America in the 18th century is one of the most equal places on earth. Ordinary people have land and have opportunities. Now, again, there are major exclusions, and that equality is, in fact, based upon those exclusions. But among the white European population, America is an equal place, and it's an abundant place.
Okay. My next question for you just has to do with the general tone of the Declaration of Independence. We've been talking a lot about happiness and then a little bit about suffering, but you know, you couldn't describe this document as a happy document. After this opening section, basically the next, you know, two-thirds of it is a long train of listing grievances.
Yeah, I love the Yiddish word kvetch, and that's appropriate here, right? I mean, Jefferson's kvetching. Americans are kvetching. It's a long list of complaints and outrages, right? And you're absolutely right. You know, and if they were talking that way all the time, they wouldn't be happy. The psychologists tell us that, you know, focusing on the negative all the time is not good for our happiness. But they certainly aren't kind of blithe optimists either. They recognize that America is in a less than happy situation, and there are specific actions that the king is taking to impede their flourishing, and they're going to address them head on. And so, yes, the declaration is a list of grievances and a statement of why America is seceding from an empire, which is something of an unprecedented situation. And I emphasize that here to make the point that, you know, my friend David Armitage at Harvard makes in his wonderful little book on the Declaration of Independence, that the Declaration of Independence is first and foremost a statement in international law. It's not first and foremost a rights document. We focus, as we are here today, on discussion of rights, and that is there. But really, until Lincoln, most people didn't read the Declaration as a statement of rights, first and foremost, but rather a declaration to a candid world of the reasons why America was seceding from an empire and beginning again.
Some people today are still angry with the Declaration of Independence and this passage about our inalienable rights and that all men are created equal. So I think it might be appropriate now to look at, as we've already discussed, the fact that while the founders were like, yes, you can have your own land here in North America, of course, it might be or was taken from Native peoples who had their own concepts of happiness and who might or might not have been included in Jefferson's concept. Of course, gender perspectives are maybe implicit in the Declaration of Independence. In fact, I think gender is only mentioned explicitly once when referring to the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. And of course, enslaved people, again, only tangentially mentioned. What do we make of these three perspectives about happiness or unhappiness or exclusion of happiness ideas in this document?
Yeah, an awful lot to unpack there.
Sorry.
And I almost don't know where to begin. Well, let's start with the phrase, you know, all men are created equal. Famously, Martin Luther King will describe this as a promissory note, and he's echoing Frederick Douglass in the 19th century, who thinks of the Declaration too as a kind of list of ideals that Jefferson and the founders don't fully live up to, that are at times hypocritical, and yet are noble in and of themselves. And so since the 18th century, we've tried to live up to that enunciation that all men are created equal. I make the point in my book on equality that actually the idea that all men are created equal is a kind of hackneyed phrase in the 18th century, another one of these kind of received notions. And you can trace that phrase all the way back to Stoic thought and Roman law, where it's often uttered in the same discussion of slavery. In other words, the idea that all men are created equal is not in inherent tension with the existence of slavery, and the equality that's posited, I think, in the Declaration is really built upon, in many ways, a kind of a notion of difference and inferiority and exclusion. That said, And I mentioned earlier the 18th century witnesses a revolution in human expectations, and people are presented for the first time with this novel idea that they're supposed to be happy, not because of, you know, their superior virtue or their good fortune or luck, but because they are human beings, that human beings have a right to pursue happiness, or maybe even have a right to happiness itself. Now, that idea doesn't just, you know, reach the world in one statement. You know, if you're a Jew in the shtetl, if you're a woman in a bad marriage, if you're, an indigenous person moved off your land, if you're an enslaved person, you don't just wake up in the 18th century and say, oh my gosh, wow, I have a right to happiness, and now I'm going to go pursue it. And yet, the idea is powerful. And so in the 19th century, you start to see, right, social movements, women's movements, workers' movements, claiming and desiring their happiness. I quote at length in the book this wonderful passage from Thomas Carlyle, who's a kind of crabby person complaining in the middle of the 19th century that every pitifulest whipster, as he put it, has had his head filled with the notion that he is and by divine right ought to be happy. And he traces that to about the end of the 17th century, and so he kind of, you know, he makes my point perfectly for me, that this idea has gotten out of the bottle. In America, you find in the 19th century, and Howard Mumford Jones, a Harvard scholar earlier in the 20th century, wrote a wonderful book on this called The Pursuit of Happiness, and he shows that you get people bringing suit in state courts of law against state governments for impeding their pursuit of happiness or indeed their ability to obtain it. Now, this is something that we haven't talked about, but the Declaration of Independence famously only talks about the pursuit of happiness, but many state constitutions talk about pursuing and obtaining happiness as an inalienable right. So George Mason in the Virginia Declaration of Right in the preamble, which is written just a couple months before the Declaration of Independence itself by Jefferson's good friend, George Mason, uses precisely that language of pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. The same language is picked up in the state of New Hampshire, where I am now at Dartmouth College, and right across the river in Vermont and in other places, New Jersey and Massachusetts and so forth. And so you find cases of African Americans bringing suits against state governments for denying their right to happiness. So, you know, that's to make the point that, you know, even if Martin Luther King exaggerates by calling the Declaration a promissory note for the future, there's a certain truth to the idea that, you know, immediately, already in 1776, African Americans are picking up on that language and asserting it, right, in defense of their rights. Are we not human beings too? Women begin to do the same thing, again, immediately, but with increasing power in the 19th century and other excluded groups.
I do want to get to Native Americans and women as well, but just the one point that I thought was interesting about the enslaved person experience, and I just learned this through talking to some scholars of African American history, is this idea of divine providence was very yeah. much connected to their experience of life. Because when we think about, for example, the Dunmore Proclamation, so the British Governor Dunmore was like, if you're an enslaved person and you join our lines, so if you flee your slaveholder, your rebel slaveholder, and join us, I will free you. Well, that decision, which frees you, maybe allows you to pursue happiness, isn't necessarily a great one. Yeah, you could stay enslaved or you could join the British Army and they'd also treat you poorly and you might get killed. So within all of the bad choices of enslaved people, their concept really was, well, divine providence will make the decision at the end whether or not I live a happy life, and because I only have bad decisions, right?
Right. Absolutely. And then that kind of received kind of Christian notion that, you know, the ultimate happiness is of the next life and this life is less important is reiterated and reaffirmed. I've just written an article, it's not out yet, but written the article on the trope of the happy slave. And sadly, this is a kind of trope that has reemerged in the United States in the 21st century to talk about the history of enslavement as if it, you know, weren't so bad somehow, and that, you know, the enslaved were really actually fairly happy, which is a kind of widespread notion among slaveholders in the 19th century. And there's a whole literature to kind of justify this. We thought we had reached the point where we didn't have to make the case, as Ta-Nehisi Coates puts it, anymore, but apparently we do. That got me interested, though. The reemergence of this idea of a happy slave got me interested in the origins of this, and so I've kind of written a genealogy of the concept, and it actually emerges in Europe in the 17th century to describe European captives who were taken by Muslim pirates in the Mediterranean. And it draws on classical roots as well. You mentioned the Stoics before. One of the most famous Stoics, Epictetus, was himself enslaved. And Epictetus, you know, in this extreme Stoic way, will say that really our day-to-day circumstances don't matter a whole lot. It's how we react to them. And there's this kind of, you know, idea that even while enslaved, we could master our circumstances. So that Stoic trope gets wielded sometimes, the Christian trope that, you know, that this life is less important than the next, that we'll be rewarded for our sufferings here below in the life after gets wielded. But of course, all this then is applied to Africans and the enslaved to effectively sort of, you know, these are people without rights who are excluded from the pursuit of happiness and the freedom that it's often thought of as necessary to pursue happiness, and then granted this other kind of happiness. It's interesting that people feel the need to even justify their emotional states in terms of happiness or unhappiness, but they do so in this quite insidious and powerful way.
Fascinating. Okay, why don't we talk then a little bit either about the Native American concepts of happiness, and this is something I don't know much about, but obviously yeah. Native Americans then and now have a different tradition of happiness. So how do we even begin to sort yeah. that out?
So I'm not at all an expert on Native American history, but when I was thinking about this question, I put it to my colleague Colin Calloway, who's, you know, a great expert and authority on Native American history in the 18th century. And his quick answer was, I don't really think it's a thing. In other words, there's not a lot of kind of, you know, conversation about happiness per se. What I would add to that, and Colin would as well, is that, you know, I mentioned earlier that really all religious traditions and wisdom traditions have lots to say about how human beings thrive and flourish and how they can, if not resist suffering outright, then learn to withstand it and lessen it. And Native American spiritual and religious practices and familial practices reaffirm these same notions without question. A great emphasis on community, which psychologists will tell you is, you know, one of the number one predictors of how happy human beings are, is how many friends they have and how embedded they feel in social networks. A sense of meaning and purpose that is cultivated, a devotion to family, and a sense of virtue in the sense of acting in the service of others and not simply for yourself. All of these things reaffirm and make for human happiness, we know in psychological terms, and they're reaffirmed and reinforced by Native American spiritual practices as well. So I think there is a absolutely kind of received thought or received traditions that deal with some of these questions. What would be really interesting to know is what happens when those received traditions then come head to head with the articulations of the pursuit of happiness that you find in the Declaration and elsewhere. You know, we focus with justice on the Trail of Tears and the kind of unhappy story of the fortunes of Native Americans in the 19th and 20th centuries. But I'd be curious to investigate further the thinking around this and about ideas of human flourishing.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject. And maybe we'll just now take a look at women. At the time, is Jefferson thinking that women are somehow and I'm now thinking of white European women with property, or who have husbands with property. Can they experience happiness in the same way a man can? Can they be virtuous in the same way a man can, or are they somehow other?
Right. So, you know, all the way back to the ancients, there is a kind of, you know, patriarchal bias built into the pursuit of virtue. I mean, Aristotle is the clearest about this. He says that women have a different kind of virtue, and there are different virtues for women. This is reinforced by Romans and Roman thought. Aristotle also famously, you know, posits that women don't have the same capacity for reason and therefore can't aspire to the same kind of flourishing that men can. And I think that idea, whether it's articulated outright or not, is passed on and is sort of baked into many of the pronouncements in the 18th century, where you do in fact see a reemergence of a clearly articulated notion of two spheres, that, you know, that public life and the pursuit of virtue in public and for the founders, virtue is a public thing. It's about contributing to public welfare and not about your own domestic life, that public life is for men and that private or domestic life is for women. And these two spheres are different. And so a woman's happiness in this conception would, you know, involve family and children and homemaking and the like, and a man's happiness would be something different. And I think that is a widely received idea that's being reaffirmed and strengthened in the 18th century and on into the 19th. That said, there are clearly people who are contesting this in the 18th century, and their voices get stronger in the 19th, and they begin to argue in a very pointed way, you know, we need to have the same opportunities to pursue happiness of our own making, right? And we need to have the agency to control things like property that are necessary for our own pursuit of happiness. But in the 18th century, that explicit appeal to the language of happiness is I think less present than one finds later, although I always like to draw attention to this wonderful little discourse on happiness written by Madame du Châtelet, who was a thinker, philosopher, scientist in the 18th century. She had a long-standing affair with Voltaire. She's the principal French translator of Isaac Newton, Principia Mathematica. And she writes a discourse on happiness, and the opening paragraph has this wonderful line where she says that in order to be happy, one must have illusions. She's writing this later in life and had fewer of those illusions than she did as a younger woman, but Châtelet sees a kind of self-imposed illusion or refusal to see everything in life as necessary to the pursuit of happiness.
Fascinating. Okay, we're coming to an end, and I just thought maybe we'd look at the last sentence of the Declaration of Independence, because having talked to you and having sort of done a close reading, just focused on happiness now, of this entire document, I really think the last sentence is fascinating because it ties together a bunch of the things we've been talking about. So the last sentence of the Declaration is, "And for the support of this Declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor," which I just read as "we mutually pledge to each other our happiness." And that when we think about not only the divine providence in the first half of that sentence, but when we think of life, fortune, and sacred honor, we have like four of these key ideas. Divine providence, so it might be that fate smiles kindly on us or allows us to be happy, or God. But then when we pledge to each other our lives, you know, we hear this idea that we see in Bentham, but also Jefferson said, the number one goal of government is to protect life. You know, that's this idea of security and safety we see in the Declaration of Independence. But they also pledge to each other, because they're wealthy landowners, their fortunes, which is fascinating. You know, ancient thought says you need to be wealthy, right? You need to have some wealth to be virtuous, and they're pledging to each other their fortunes. And of course, all of this is tied up in this concept of sacred honor or virtue, which might have some religious connotations as well. So I've just totally reread that last sentence to be that we're actually pledging to each other by signing this everything we have, which is happiness.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And you've reframed those lines for me as well. I think it does reaffirm this point too, that when the founders conceived of happiness, again, they thought of it in terms of community. And this is important, I think, because, you know, I've talked about the religious origins of the phrase, the pursuit of happiness, the classical philosophical underpinnings of that understanding in the 18th century, and how the founders could not have conceived of the pursuit of happiness without the pursuit of virtue. But at the same time, there is this new idea that emerges in the 18th century that happiness and pleasure go hand in hand. I mentioned Jeremy Bentham before, and Bentham says this outright, that happiness is simply pleasure, right? And so what makes pleasure for one person is not going to be the same as what makes pleasure or happiness for another. Locke is already on this in the 17th century. He has this wonderful line where he says, you know, happiness for some men will be lobster, for others for cheese, right? If we're just calculating purely on pleasure. And I think what happens in the 18th century, and you find this in the Declaration, is this tension between the individual pursuit of pleasure, right, through, you know, wealth, through commodities, through luxury, through purchasing, is put in tension with this older received idea of happiness as the pursuit of virtue. The founders don't fully see that tension because they're so steeped in their religious and classical inheritance. But as we move forward in time into the 19th century, that religious and classical tradition frays somewhat. And there's more and more emphasis on the individual pursuit of happiness. And here I like to call attention to that word pursuit. Samuel Johnson, in his Dictionary of the English Language, describes the verb to pursue as to follow in hostility. And if you think of, you know, pursuing, and in fact, a criminal prosecutor in 19th century Scotland is called a pursuer, right? And if you think of pursuing happiness in these terms, it takes on a different inflection. I think it's captured a little bit in the German phrase Sehnsucht nach Glück, right? Sehnsucht has a sense of anxiety, right? A little bit. The French talk about la chasse au bonheur, the hunt for happiness. And I love that because, of course, when you hunt something, what happens when you find it? You kill it. And I think that if you think about the pursuit of happiness as this individual pursuit of modicums of pleasure, we run up against, you know, what the psychologists call the hedonic treadmill, right? You get a bit of pleasure and it wears off really soon. And then you feel anxiety and you need more. And our economy today thrives on that very notion. And I think the founders in some ways unwittingly set that monster in motion.
And funnily enough, though, we were talking about prudence earlier and Epicurus was mentioned. The ancients actually had the solution to this hedonic trap, saying everything in moderation. You don't want to get too used to your luxuries because then it's painful for you when you lose them. Professor McMahon, we're coming to an end. I always ask my guests, here we are celebrating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. What do you think about? What's your big takeaway as you're thinking about this anniversary?
Yeah, I have to say it's wonderful to read the Declaration. It also makes me a little sad, frankly. It's wonderful because it's wonderful to remember America that fought against tyranny and injustice, that, you know, articulated ideals that maybe it didn't always live up to, that maybe at times were hypocritical, but nonetheless were ideals nonetheless: equality, liberty, justice. It's wonderful to remember America that still considered the candid opinion of the world and thought that was important and sought to justify its actions in the world before the world. That America is harder to see these days. And so I read this with powerful emotion, but also a certain sadness.
Professor Darren McMahon, thank you very much. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of liberty, the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, AmericaCentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The AmericaCentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaCentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.